I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from West Asia, where what some are calling a third world war widens amidst mass censorship in NATO nations of news and information in arguably a Chomskyan propaganda model on steroids, with Britain and the US bombing Yemen and Iraq and US proxies bombing Syria and Palestine and Lebanon. Expressing dissent has never been more difficult amidst a declining American empire. Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, tortured in Britain, has perhaps never been more emblematic of the savagery of a dying hegemon, and our guest today is suing the former boss of the CIA over him. Since the 7th of October, a journalist or media worker has been killed every 2 days in the Gaza genocide alone, and Israel is even killing poets. Charles Glass is an award-winning foreign correspondent who's covered conflict in Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, to Somalia and Eritrea in Western Europe. His latest book is Soldiers Don't Go Mad, about poets, and he joins me now from Florence in Italy. Charles, good to see you again. Obviously, there's been so much killing in Gaza just this week, while I guess in Italy and in Western Europe, they're talking about retaliation against Iran. A poet in Gaza, Rifat Alaria, was killed in December. Just before we go into the events of this week and World War III, arguably, tell me about Soldiers Don't Go Mad. Rifat wasn't a soldier, but in World War I, soldiers were poets.
Many soldiers were poets. It was a very well-educated generation, particularly among the officer class. They were raised on Keats and Shelley and other famous British poets, Shakespeare, Milton. They could quote them at length, particularly a poet like Robert Graves or Siegfried Sassoon, or Wilfred Owen, all of whom were officers in the British Army in the war, and all of whom suffered something called shell shock, which we now call post-traumatic stress disorder. My book is really about the effect that the war had on those men who were treated at a particular mental hospital called the Craig Lockhart War Hospital for Officers, where Siegfried Sassoon met Wilfred Owen, and together they improved each other's poetry and also helped each other to mental recovery.
It's an exhaustive book about that, what we now call PTSD. But do you think Wilfred Owen, Sassoon are being read by, say, the British ambassador to the UN, let alone Linda Thomas Greenfield of the US, when they refuse to veto, they veto resolutions, ceasefire resolutions at the UN Security Council? Because I don't know what you've been thinking you've been promoting the book, perhaps, as well, as we hear the 100,000 perhaps killed or wounded, mostly women and children, not soldiers, in the Gaza Strip?
I don't know what diplomats are reading these days. Certainly in the past, they would have read Sassoon and Owen and Graves. Sassoon is particularly relevant here because he was urging a diplomatic resolution of the First World War, much as people are urging an end to the slaughter in Gaza through negotiations and diplomacy rather than continued bloodshed. He wrote a protest about the war, and he felt that the British war aims were duplicitous, that they were really fighting for imperial gain, that France was fighting to take parts of Germany that the Germans had conquered in the War of 1870, and that they were not really defending freedom, that they were actually killing young men like Sassoon's entire generation in order to achieve their imperialistic aims. It would be worth reading that protest today, I think, because that was why Sassoon was sent to a mental hospital rather than court-martialing and put the war on trial, because Sassoon was a very prominent poet and a very prominent person from a very distinguished background. They sent him to a mental hospital, much as the Soviet Union used to send people to mental hospitals if they were dissidents. He was a dissident, in effect, a political prisoner.
Yeah, I mean, psychiatric cases redolent of the USSR. You know, one of the first things done in Ukraine after the 2014 coup was they banned Russian poetry. They took down, I think, more than 30 statues of Pushkin. What was it like in Western Europe? What was your view of how, regardless of your view on what was happening, as regards the conflict in Europe, why it was that NATO powers backed, I mean, the renaming of Pushkin Park, obviously Dostoevsky was famously banned, Russian soprano Anna Trebenko banned in the USA from the Met, conductors, Valery Gergiev. This relationship between art, so important, so frightening to NATO nations that they need to ban poetry and poets.
It's not unusual in war for people to overreact and to take out against a culture what is really a political issue. In the United States during the First World War, German restaurants were attacked. Germans were lynched. The German language was effectively banned. The United States used to have thousands of German newspapers, which were shut down or had to convert to English. German was, after English, the second most spoken language in the country. This is not unusual in wartime for people to forget that despite your differences, culture unites people. At the Craig Lockhart Hospital, for example, they never stopped playing German composers in the Saturday concerts because they felt that it was right to respect German culture even though they were fighting a German enemy.
Except Tchaikovsky, I understand concerts of his have been banned in NATO countries, and you know, T.S. Eliot is being read in Moscow, no problem. I mean, do you think the entire global South, much of whom supports a new world order, arguably, and believes there is World War III going on, whether it be Ukraine, whether it be Gaza, that the war has already begun and they're allowing poetry and art to continue, but it's not happening in NATO nations? Do you think World War III has begun?
No, I don't believe World War III has begun. If it had begun, we'd all be dead now. There'd be nuclear weapons destroying the entire planet. No, I don't believe World War III has begun. I think that there are differences. Russia has invaded Ukraine. People don't like that. They don't like,
people in Western Europe and the United States.
Iraq and Afghanistan. The issue is not to demonize the other just because you have a conflict with him. And that, to me, it should be universal. It's not right that Tchaikovsky should be banned or that Beethoven should have been banned or that German language newspapers should have been banned during the First World War. That's just not right. I mean, I believe in freedom of speech. I believe in respecting the cultures of others, but we can still have opinions about the justice or injustice of invading other countries.
You see, some would say that cultural accompaniment, as it were, is as one with the way so-called mainstream media, where you are in Italy, in Western Europe, in the United States, has never been so bad when it comes to the genocide in Gaza. What have you felt about the reporting of...
There was an interesting piece at The Intercept, which is a very good website, by the way, about a memo at the New York Times instructing people not to use the word massacre when it's replied to.
Well, they're not allowed to use the word genocide. There's a memo to all employees at the New York Times saying don't use the word genocide, occupied territory, or even Palestine.
Yes, and see, that's just not right. You can't tell your reporters how to frame their reporting. And I think the New York Times is oversensitive to this issue. They've done some of their reporting has been excellent, but much of it has been abysmal. It varies from reporter to reporter and day to day. But overall, if the editorial policy is to favor one side over the other, then that's simply wrong. I mean, you have to be fair and objective. And treat both sides the same, but they're for the most part, they're not doing that. Not just the New York Times, many newspapers. But that said, some journalists, and you know them as well as I do, Jeremy Bohr at the BBC.
He had to apologize for his reporting to the BBC, Jeremy Bowen, some years ago.
But his reporting has been first rate and fair, just as Lise Doucette's had, just as Paul Adams has. The BBC's been very good. Jason Burke at The Guardian and The Observer, also very good.
I think I'd have to differ about some of those reporters. But, you know, you're a fan of Chomsky, you were.
I'm a friend of Noam Chomsky.
Yeah, I mean, he's been on this show. And the whole point of the Chomsky model is you don't have to send memos from management to journalists because there's a kind of censorship by default that goes on. That's the Chomsky model. What do you make of the fact it's so explicit, the commands, as it were, to journalists? Have you ever seen anything like that?
In places where I've worked, I never received anything like that. No, it's unusual, and maybe the New York Times has just gone overboard because they probably had a lot of complaints about some of their reporting, which wasn't pro-Israeli enough.
And yet, if you see the demonstrations in the United States, the poor poll numbers in important voting blocks ahead of November's election, I don't think we've ever seen such pro-Palestine movements in the United States. What do you make of the fact that what was once considered anti-Semitic, i.e. to support even a two-state solution, let alone a one-state solution, has got so much traction in the United States, which has traditionally not been as pro-justice in the Middle East as perhaps...
Well, public opinion polls have for many years shown that the American public has favored an independent Palestinian state, I mean, consistently for years. But that doesn't mean it filters through to Congress or to the White House. The public has long favored a solution, preferably a two-state solution, to end this bloodshed. But the bloodshed now is so egregious and so obvious. I mean, over 30,000 people, men, women, and children killed, and probably three or four times that number severely wounded. I mean, this can't go on. I mean, somebody's got to put a stop to it. I mean, a responsible imperial power or overall power would have stepped in a long time ago to say, look, this is enough. Enough suffering has been caused. It could lead to a regional conflict, a serious regional conflict, in which American interests would be severely threatened. It is time to put a stop to it. And the public knows this, but the leadership isn't following the public.
I mean, you've been critical of a lack of Arab solidarity as regards the Palestine question, but of course, in the past few months, really, is it? The Chinese brokered deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran. How important is that going to be in the coming week, perhaps, if one believes the, some might say, hysterical headlines in a lot of mainstream media, so-called, in Western Europe, that there has to be retaliation from Israel for the kind of re-retaliation for the Iranian response to the bombing of their consulate in Damascus?
I think it's worth comparing the Arab reaction to the October 1973 war, when Egypt and Syria went to war with Israel in order to regain the territories that they had lost in 1967. At that time, Saudi Arabia led the way to have an Arab oil boycott of the West that supported Israel. And that helped to bring an end to that war fairly quickly, and to diplomatic talks that should even at that time have led to a Palestinian state. This time, where the killing is much worse and the Palestinian suffering much, much worse, the Arab states have not enacted an oil embargo on anyone. They haven't done anything except pay a bit of lip service to the Palestinian cause in order to placate their own populations, who are outraged by what's happening, and they've done basically nothing. They haven't. The Arab states that have diplomatic relations with Israel haven't even severed them. It's their reaction. The Palestinians cannot rely on their Arab brothers in any way. They can't. In fact, it's a bit like we used to say about the Kurds. The Kurds have no friends but the mountains. Well, the Palestinians don't even have the mountains.
Charles Glass, I'll stop you there. More from the award-winning foreign correspondent and author of Soldiers Don't Go Mad after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the award-winning foreign correspondent and author of Soldiers Don't Go Mad, Charles Glass. Charles, we were talking about the response in this region in West Asia to the terrible events in Gaza. I suppose both of us would love it if I could talk to you right now, and in another box there'd be Julian Assange giving his diagnosis of geopolitics at the moment as Russia, China, BRICS get closer, and yet in NATO countries the talk is continually of continuing war in Europe, no negotiations, and there are no negotiations on the table as such as regards Gaza. Do you think Assange is becoming more and more emblematic, his case of press freedom and secrecy?
Julian Assange is a victim of those who want to conceal crime. war crimes. And he's been punished for having made available documents that were released to him by whistleblowers from within the establishment that prove that the United States in particular had committed war crimes. And he's being punished for that. And he not only being punished for that, but also being used as an example to others so that they don't do the same thing. If Julian were free now and WikiLeaks were up and running, we would know a lot more about US policy on Gaza. We would know a lot more about what the Israelis are planning in Gaza. We would know much more about plans for the United States to deal with Iran. But Julian isn't able to function. He's locked up for 23 hours a day in a cell, allowed out 1 hour a day in a confined, enclosed space for exercise, barely has enough to eat. The budget at Belmarsh Maximum Security Prison is $2 a day for food. He's suffering a great deal. He still doesn't know if ultimately he will be sent to the United States to spend the rest of his life in even worse a confinement in an American maximum security prison. His life is hell. And we're actually, all of us, the public, are suffering a lack of knowledge because he's not there, because WikiLeaks isn't functioning, because we're not able to find out many of the state secrets that we used to have access to.
You see, in part one, you mentioned all these journalists. I don't hear them talking about Assange. You went to visit him, I understand. I haven't seen him since our interviews. People can watch them on our Rumble channel from inside the Ecuadorian embassy during political asylum. What was it like for you personally to see him in that state? I mean, I think last time I saw you, he was giving press conferences at the Frontline Club, which even that kind of turned against him. People, I remember, telling me he's a sort of traitor. He's not really a journalist. He's a... I'm not sure what they thought of him. A Russian asset? Who knows what they have smeared him with?
Many journalists had turned against Julian, including editors of newspapers and others. Others like Patrick Coburn, the late John Pilger, have stood by him and have been vociferous in their defense of him and his right to publish. There's a division in the journalistic community on him. However, now that it's so close to his extradition, his potential extradition, all the major newspapers in the United States, the Reporters Without Borders and other journalistic organizations, even the National Union of Journalists in Britain, have come to his defense and say he should not be punished.
And what was it like for you going there to maximum security prison in London in December?
Well, I hadn't seen him since he'd been put in Belmarsh 5 years previously. And he doesn't look the same. I mean, he's completely pale. He hasn't seen the sun and he hasn't had any sunlight at all in years. He's lost weight because he doesn't have enough to eat. He's weak, but he's alert. His mind is still functioning. He's as sharp as ever. He's aware of what's going on in the world. He still isn't engaging and funny as he always was. I rate Julian very highly as one of the bravest men I have ever met in my life. And he still is that brave man.
The United States, of course, gave an assurance this week they won't kill him. Why are you suing the head of the CIA as regards the Assange?
I'm not suing the head of the CIA. I'm suing the former, not me, but two lawyers and one other journalist and I are jointly suing the former head of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, for, in 2017 and 18, eavesdropping on our conversations with Julian, taking our cell phones and taking all the information off our cell phones and putting spyware on our cell phones, which because we're American citizens and because lawyer-client conversations are privileged, we are under the Fourth Amendment of the United States suing Mike Pompeo and the CIA of that time.
And yet, of course, the U.S. making this assurance they don't want to kill him when Pompeo clearly said he wanted to kill him, and Hillary Clinton, we know, said drone bomb him. I understand a friend of hers, Amal Clooney, was actually on the WikiLeaks team bizarrely. I don't think she defends Julian Assange now in these bizarre court proceedings going through London. What did you think of these assurances from the Biden administration that they wouldn't kill Julian Assange?
Well, first of all, Pompeo was proposing an extrajudicial assassination of Julian, not that he should be executed, which extrajudicial assassinations are also illegal. We have a new condition, which is that the British court has said that they will not be, Julian cannot be extradited to the United States if he's going to face the death penalty, because that's illegal in Britain and in the rest of Europe. So the US has had to give that assurance. They have not met all the assurances that the court asked for. The court has also asked that he receive the same protections under the First Amendment that an American citizen would receive. And the US, rather than give that assurance, has said that that would be up to the US courts. So this has put the British court in a very difficult position. I think they want to extradite him in order to please the United States, but the US has not met the conditions that the court has set. So I think Julian's appeal will probably go through, and it may turn out that he won't be extradited. Extradited. That's what we're all hoping.
Because I understand they can't give the First Amendment rights because of the Guantanamo torture camp, which is still in operation. And the British courts, though, are they really in a difficult position? They have explicit documentation explaining of assassination attempts or planning against Julian Assange.
The Guantanamo case has nothing to do with the First Amendment in any case. That's something else.
I understand the lawyers there for those people tried to get First Amendment rights for captives there. What's your opinion? They couldn't give
in
the
any,
assurance.
In any case, the court is in a difficult position in Britain if it wants to please the United States, which the British invariably try to do, but also conform to British law. And British law right now has not received the assurances that it has asked for, and so they may not be able to extradite him and may allow further appeal to go ahead.
This, of course, after the judge in the British court said all the other stuff about public interest, all the other stuff about the assassination attempt allegations, UC Global, you might want to tell us and remind us about that, are irrelevant to the extradition request. All the torture claims by UN rapporteur Niels Meltzer, who's been on this show, what did you make of the fact all of that is judged irrelevant?
Well, that's what I'm saying. They're trying to please the United States, and yet the United States isn't making it easy for them because they haven't given all the assurances that the court has asked for.
And what did you make of the fact that WikiLeaks lawyers didn't apply for bail?
Well, they did initially, but the court at the very beginning wouldn't grant it. Remember, he had to serve 50 weeks for his original bail jumping. And then after that, they wanted him to be released on bail. But because he jumped bail the first time, the court wouldn't grant it.
I mean, can you see that in the Global South, people are looking at this and thinking, why would you expect court systems in Britain, which has been a party to torture? I think only this week the case on Abu Ghraib has been talked about, a party certainly to the invasion of Iraq. The United States, which has a torture camp in Guantanamo, where we know of black sites and so on, the idea that they don't kill people who want to exercise First Amendment rights is unsurprising.
Well, there's great hypocrisy, of course. I mean, the United States, Biden on World Press Freedom Day said the United States is dedicated to press freedom. And at the same time, he's making sure that Julian Assange is kept in a maximum security prison in Britain, awaiting extradition to a maximum security prison in the United States. And there's great hypocrisy, and we all know it. Not only in the Global South, people in the United States, in Britain, and probably even in Dubai are aware of it.
And I haven't seen you on so-called mainstream media in NATO countries commenting that much about the genocide. I presume that's not because you don't want to talk about it. Albeit the guests that these sorts of television programs have, it doesn't seem to be getting through the so-called Hasbara Israeli propaganda. How are Israel failing in getting their message across as they normally have done over the decades?
their spokesmen are still getting their message out. I don't know if people believe them anymore because their message is contradicted by what people are seeing happening on the ground. I mean, although they won't admit foreign, the Israelis and the Egyptians won't allow foreign journalists into Gaza to report, there are many Palestinian journalists, many of whom have been killed, many Palestinian journalists who are there recording on video and audio and writing about what's happening there every day. It's undeniable. So the propaganda just isn't, no propaganda is ever going to be good enough to conceal these facts.
We know the generational impact of, say, Sabra and Shatila, of the Second Intifada and so on. I suppose going back to your book, talking about the horrors of the First World War, as expressed by the subaltern classes in Britain, how long will it take for this region to recover, let alone the people of Palestine, from what's been happening these past 6 months?
It's not only what's been happening these past 6 months, it's what's going to happen in the next 6 months. I mean, there's a risk of a major conflict between Israel and Iran. There's a risk of a further conflagration in Gaza if the IDF goes into Rafah. There's a risk of the exodus of a million or more Palestinians into the Sinai Desert. There's a risk of war between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon, which would mean probably the total destruction of Lebanon and destruction of many Israeli cities. But what we've seen so far is nothing to what we might see in the coming months. It's a terrifying prospect. I think it's worth mentioning that Israel bombed a diplomatic mission in another country. When Al-Qaeda bombed American diplomatic missions in Dar es Salaam and Nairobi, the U.S. bombed the hell out of Afghanistan. Immediate reaction. And yet Biden says nothing about this is a violation of the Vienna Convention. It is a violation of international law. And it's like it didn't happen, and like the Iranian missile response was just, you know, some crazy thing that the mullahs did.
Charles Glass, thank you. And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to the survivors of US, UK, EU nation armed killing in Palestine, Syria, Yemen, Lebanon, Iran, and Iraq. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Monday with redacted co-host Natalie Morris. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.